Welcome to Worlds Apart. The great German playwright Friedrich von Schiller remarked 2 centuries ago that friends show us what we can do, while foes teach us what we should do. Historically, Russia and Germany have been both close collaborators and mortal enemies whose tried and tested relationship laid the groundwork for peace and prosperity in Europe over the last 50 years. What awaits the continent now that these connections are being purposefully severed at America's bidding? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Harley Schlanger, Vice President of the Schiller Institute. Mr. Schlanger, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much for your invitation.
Now, let us start with the practical things. I know that Germans used to be known for their practicality and attention to business. And the other day, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz remarked that one of the, I guess, silver linings of the current confrontation between Russia and the West in Ukraine is the fact that Germany is on track of being fully liberated from its dependence on Russia's energy sources. Is that full freedom as far as you're concerned, or just trading one dependence for another?
Well, you now have the freedom to freeze, the freedom to not have food. The current government in Germany is a disaster, in that it's trying to use the situation that's outside of its control to carry out a transition, which I think is a foolish transition. We at the Schiller Institute think that the idea of a zero net carbon world doesn't function. And what's needed is new technologies. And what's needed also is collaboration. And instead, the idea that somehow we can use a war for a transition to a policy which won't work makes no sense. And I think the coalition is starting to fall apart because people are going out into the streets in Germany, as they are throughout Europe. And we just saw the fiasco in Great Britain. So I think the Western world is facing the kind of transformation that they're not ready for.
You mentioned that there has been a change of power in Great Britain. There were also some changes in other countries like Italy or Sweden. But I would argue that the change of leadership happened without a change of policies. How long do you think it will take before actual changes, some sort of connection to reality happens?
Well, it depends on how dedicated the people who are pushing these changes are. I saw the demonstrations signs from Paris and Rome in the last couple of days with signs saying out of the EU, out of NATO. That's a shift. And I don't think the governments that have been elected are ready to leave the European Union or NATO, but the people are. The people are being told you have to freeze for the sake of NATO. And I don't think that's a good selling point in Germany or anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, can I ask you something? And maybe that's my sort of tyrannical heritage posing this question. But I think people in the West invest too much in the power of protest, you know, taking to the streets to change policy. And historically, if we are objective, you know, there have been massive protests against the war in Iraq. Many millions of people took to the streets across several continents. But that changed nothing. And right now we are seeing, as you say, many protests in many European capitals. But is it really effective in terms of changing the main course of policies that the elites have chosen and seem to be clinging onto?
Well, I think the elites are beginning to realize that their established policies aren't working. And when there are people in the streets, it gives them an excuse to change policies. For example, what's happening in the United Kingdom? The fact that millions of people are having only one meal a day, or they're turning their heat down, they're worried about freezing this winter. That has an impact eventually. And I think what we're seeing is the establishment in the Tory party trying to decide, is it worth sticking with this war against Russia and Ukraine for the sake of NATO and European Union? And that's where protests make a difference. Mm-hmm. That they give people a chance to shift policy, and they can always say, well, we're being popular. That's what happened with the Vietnam War. It took a long time, but the establishment finally turned against it in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, while we're seeing, as you say, very, very minor shifts in the policies, there are also major changes in how the European economy is structured. And I mentioned in the beginning the disruption of gas trade between Russia and Germany. And we all know that any decision has, comes with its own price tag. It's no secret that the Americans are selling their LNG to Europe at a price four times higher than they charge domestically. Mm-hmm. Plus, there is a real logistical issue with the shortage of LNG tankers. When we put all those factors together, what do you think this new energy arrangement, whatever it is, because I think at this point of time, it's not even constellated, but what do you think this new energy arrangement would mean both for the German industry and for the German style of life?
German industry is protesting quite vigorously right now, at least through the official channels. They're basically saying we're being deindustrialized. We're going to lose 1.5 million industrial jobs in Germany. Germany's the motor of Europe's economy. If that happens, it's going to be felt in every country. When Germany catches a cold, it's pneumonia in the rest of the continent. Now, the fact is that the chancellor was forced to shift, at least minimally, on the anti-nuclear policy. So they'll keep three plants open until next April. But there's a fight from industry saying that's not adequate. When Scholz went to the Middle East to try and come up with oil and natural gas, it didn't work. There are limited options. And now something to keep an eye on. I just was informed today that the Treasury, U.S. Treasury Department and State Department sent three officials to Turkey to warn the Turkish government about becoming too closely linked with Russia. So any of these changes are going to come with a political brawl. And we'll see to what extent the NATO threat and the threat coming from the United States can keep these countries in line.
Can I ask you something about Germany being the motor of the European economy? Because the other day, there was a news that Volkswagen, the German car manufacturer, is considering moving its production to the United States, which I think is a very noteworthy news, not only economically, but also symbolically. What does the folk, the people, think about it?
Well, those are not going to be German jobs if they're moved to the United States. There's a secondary problem, though, which is whether there's a skilled labor force large enough in the United States to have Volkswagen succeed. Look, the strategy for German industry has been to work with Russia and to work with China. Volkswagen had big moves to China in the last decade. And now you have reports coming out from the anti-Russian think tanks, such as the Atlantic Council and the Chatham House, warning that it's a mistake for Europe to be linked to industrial projects with China and Russia. But you know what this comes back to? This is the old British geopolitics from 1900. The idea that a Russian-German alliance is the existential threat for the British system. And the Americans didn't always have that view, but since the collapse of the Soviet Union, most in America have adopted that. And that's why, you know, the old slogan of NATO was the purpose of NATO is keep the US in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. When will the Germans break with that? That's the issue that I think is going to determine whether Europe can be moved out of this wartime alliance into a potential for a new security and financial architecture.
We hear a lot in the European Union that, you know, they secured peace through common trade, but for the Soviet Union, creating this, you know, network of pipelines with Germany and broader Europe was also an investment into peace. I mean, that security infrastructure existed, and it existed through trade. And I agree with you that this is the old Anglo-Saxon scheme. What I don't understand is why the Germans, who at least we in Russia believe that Germans have a better understanding of history, a better knowledge of history than most Americans or the Brits, why do they go along with it?
Well, let's take a look at two simple historic examples. The Rapallo Treaty, 100 years ago in 1922, when Walter Rathenau worked out an arrangement with the Soviet Union that broke with the Versailles Agreement. What happened to Rathenau? He was assassinated 2 months later. Go then to 1989, when the fall of the Soviet Union raised the question of what would Germany's policy be towards Russia? And you had Bush and Thatcher and Mitterrand basically saying, we can't let Russia reemerge as a power. But you had in Germany, the Alfred Herrhausen of Deutsche Bank, who wanted to invest in upgrading Russian industry. He realized you had a skilled labor force, you had a market potential. He was assassinated. So I think that there's been this threat that is very palpable. Same thing with Enrico Mattei in Italy in 1960, when he was trying to work out an agreement with the Soviets. So this is, it's the use of force, whether it's NATO, whether it's deployment of terrorists.
There's a lot of talk here in Russia that the Americans are actually interested in the repeat of a paperclip operation, when they take not only industrial facilities from the old Europe, but its best specialists, its best expertise. Do you think that's a conspiracy theory, or do you think something like that is actually being...
Just look at the Yeltsin. Look at the Yeltsin period, the shock therapy policy, supposedly designed to help Russia modernize. All it did was transfer wealth out of the hands of Russians and bring in a few oligarchs as co-workers, co-benefactors. But the geopolitics as a theory is always connected to money, connected to control of resources, control of industry. The whole green policy is a deindustrialization policy, deindustrialization against Germany. Remember, after World War II, there were people who said Germany should never be allowed to industrialize again. And thankfully, Franklin Roosevelt didn't have that idea. And we saw Germany emerge as a strong economy and democratic nation. That's not the view so much anymore. And the deindustrialization of Germany will have a profound negative impact on peace. And when you mention the question of pipelines as part of a new financial architecture, we also see the emergence of things such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasian Economic Forum, and the BRICS. The BRICS are growing. The Saudis want to come into the BRICS. These are real questions for the global South, the former non-aligned nations that didn't want to be part of a bloc. Now they're seeing the potential because of Russia and China and India also, that there is life after the collapse of the Anglo-American system. So this is something I think is getting through to the British. I don't think it's getting through to the Americans yet. But I think what we're seeing in Britain is an attempt to adapt to the potential that this war and this policy is not going to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Mr. Schlanger, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Harley Schlanger, Vice President of the Schiller Institute. Mr. Schlanger, before the break, we mentioned the concept of das Volk, the people, and I did it on purpose because in this confrontation between Russia and the West, we often hear references to Nazism, and this concept of das Volk was critical for Adolf Hitler. He actually saw the people, das Volk, as a natural unit of humanity and believed that the whole and the sole purpose of the state was to serve the people. I wonder if this German anxiety around the question of national interest is at least partially related to Germany's Nazi wound. Is it somehow shameful to stand up for your country, for your country's interest, because this is something that Nazis used to extol?
Well, I would argue that he didn't really stand for national interest, but that his government represented
an example. He articulated that idea, at least.
He put that out there, but it was really a government of corporations, of corporate cartels, including trust arrangements with British and American firms. But the point you're making is quite an important one, which is that in Germany after World War II, there was this collective guilt that was imposed on the German people. And I'm an American, but when I first started coming to Germany, I realized that people were afraid to sing the German national anthem, which is a beautiful song based on a melody from Joseph Haydn. They were embarrassed because they thought it made them look like ultra-nationalist neo-Nazis. So I think love of one's country is absolutely crucial to live a full life. But as Schiller said, you should be a patriot of your nation, but a citizen of the world. And I think the Germans sometimes think ideally of being citizens in the world, but they're scared of being identified as nationalists.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about nationalism, I think there are two distinct kinds of nationalism that we're seeing emerging around the world right now. And they're actually at war with each other. One is the sort of mono-ethnic or mono-ideological nationalism of the kind we're seeing, I would argue, in Ukraine, also in Poland. And the second kind is represented by Russia, poly-ethnic or even imperial nationalism. But I think the crucial difference between the two of them is how differently they approach diversity. Russia, because it's so multifaceted, it has right to come up with its own way of dealing with those differences, whereas in Ukraine or in Poland, those differences are being eliminated, and sometimes quite forcefully. Now, one would think that because of all its historical sensibilities, Germany would be opposed to mono-ethnic, mono-ideological form of nationalism, but it is not. Why?
Well, the irony here is that the Germans should be embarrassed about providing arms to a military which has embedded within it neo-Nazi units. And that should be the first thing that a German should be upset about. And yet the media consistently denies that the Azov Brigade and the right sector, the Pravi sector and others have Nazi backgrounds, or that Stefan Bandera was a Nazi collaborator during World War II. Now, on the nationalism question, look, there's a form of nationalism which is, in the United States, it's America first, the idea of separating and isolating from the rest of the world. And we're seeing that somewhat in Poland, the Ukrainian nationalism you're mentioning. But I think what we see with President Putin and what I would like to see in Germany and the United States is leaders who define a mission for a nation, a national mission, you know, bringing justice to the world, peace, economic development, cooperation. That's where you can be proud of your nation, but seeing your nation as working for the mutual benefit of other nations. That was the original idea of the Peace of Westphalia, which ended the 30 years war in Europe, which unfortunately, since 1999, Tony Blair said that era is over. We now have a responsibility to protect. In other words, regime change against governments we don't like. That's the problem in the West right now.
Yeah, and Mr. Schlanger, I think it's also concurrent with that quote from Friedrich Schiller, which you mentioned a moment ago about being an authentic patriot and also being a citizen of the world. I don't think there is any contradiction between these two terms. Speaking of which, I know that Schiller, Goethe, and many other German writers and thinkers are still very much appreciated in Russia, in fact, I think much of the Russian population, despite the current circumstances, remain Germanophiles, including the leader of this country. And we do have this stereotype of the Germans as practical, national people who are friendly with the critical thinking, who know how to use it, people who are punctual, people who try to be fair to themselves and the rest of the world, who are conscientious. Is that still a prominent part of the German national character?
Well, I was laughing because of the question of Pünktlichkeit, being on time. In Germany, the younger generation is very much now like the Americans, where time is relative and you don't worry about wasting someone else's time. But no, I think the broader point you're making is a real one. I have young children in the schools here, and we have one teacher who I talked to who said, well, she'd like to introduce Schiller, but it's not part of the curriculum anymore. Just as in the United States, Shakespeare is being taken out of the schools. So the great classical thinkers who provide an insight into how human civilization developed are being taken away. Once you do that, you rip away an anchor which connects the past and the present and hopefully the future. And I think when Helga Zeppler-Rusch founded the Schiller Institute, the idea was that we want to revive these great humanistic classical principles on both sides of the Atlantic at that time. Because at that point, you had a split developing between the United States and Germany. You had the missile crisis in Europe in the 1980s. So in 1984, we set up the Schiller Institute, which is now in virtually every country around the world. And I think we're finding a resonance for these very ideas. And I think it'll happen in Germany also, because in Germany, the idea of classical culture is still there, but it's now being under assault in the same way it is in the West generally.
Do you think that's just because people are ignorant and don't appreciate that great culture, or is it being done on purpose? Because as far as I'm concerned, it's not just about the connection between the past and the present. It's about what makes a human being a fully fledged individual or free to make their own judgments. Do you think that's just the way it is, or do you think somebody actually has a plan for trying to get rid of this heritage?
Well, I was a graduate student in 1972 when I met Lyndon LaRouche. And what he talked about to us was that the rock, sex, drug counterculture, which was taking over the campuses and embedded within the anti-war movement, was an operation to destroy the traditional sense of the commitment to the idea of progress, which was embedded in the U.S. Constitution and was the outlook of our best presidents, such as George Washington, Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt. You take that away and start to say that anything goes. I think Sergei Lavrov talks about post-Christian culture in the West. You see that. You see this sense that whatever you want, you should do. And it's not that you have value judgments against people. You try to understand what people are doing, but you can't understand what people are doing if you have no grounding or mooring for yourself. And I think by taking that away from people, you create a situation where people become indifferent to the suffering that's being imposed by your nation on other nations. And that, to me, is the most horrible aspect of this, that the United States is starving people in Afghanistan, starving people in Yemen with sanctions, is committed to destroying the living standards of the people in Russia. For what purpose? For the purpose of weakening Russia and making sure that the unipolar order is left unchallenged. And that, to me, is the highest level of immorality, which gets right at this question that you're talking about, tearing away that which is most beautiful in Western culture.
Now, we are also witnessing a very interesting phenomenon of canceling Russia, or canceling the Russian culture, when you have institutions banning classical works of Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, as well as banning Russian performers from giving concerts. And I think that shows that the reaction to Russia is very intense, very strong. And I heard some people here in Russia suggest that this level of demonization and trying to ostracize Russia is actually reflective, and it's so intense because of the Europe's own fear of themselves, if you know what I mean, that they are trying to project their own fears, their own memories of what have been done in Europe, because let's be honest, traditionally Russia's major security threats always came from Europe, both the French and the German armies, and the you know, the extent of carnage that was visited on this country is unparalleled. Do you think there's any truth to that, that the Europeans hate the Russians so much at this point because they're actually very much afraid of themselves and what they can do?
I'm not sure that the Europeans hate the Russians. I think there's an attempt to do that with these stories of barbarism in Ukraine and so on. And they're ignoring what the West has done, whether it was Iraq or Libya, or even the fact that the situation in Ukraine didn't start in February 2022. It started in February 2014 when the West carried out a coup against a democratically elected government. So, you know, I think there's a real shortage of historic knowledge in the West, and they're playing on that. But I can tell you one thing. I'm taking my children to see the Nutcracker this Christmas. And, you know, the idea that you can destroy a culture because it supposedly it is contributing to racism. Well, you know, that's for individuals to determine. And the idea that you're going to try and get rid of Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky and so on is an absurd characteristic of Western nihilism. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's only absurd if you don't actually think that they're trying to get rid of people's depth, you know, real psychological depth.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
if you look at those writers, you know, Dostoevsky, Schiller, Goethe, Shakespeare, they're all about what it means to be a human at the most difficult point in your life. And if you limit access to that knowledge for the people, that makes it very easy to manipulate their political opinions. And that's indeed one of the ways of turning an individual into a crowd, a faceless crowd. Now, President Putin has given many speeches. He's pretty straightforward about having no qualms to use military force to defend Russia's national interests. But he also made it clear that he is eager to come to the negotiating table, and he's eager to discuss peace with the Ukrainians. There are rumors here in Moscow that the meeting between Putin and Zelensky may take place at the G20 summit at Indonesia, even though that has not been confirmed. I wonder, what's your sense of the conflict's dynamics? Do you think we have come to a point where the benefits of peace would overweigh the benefits of war?
Well, I think we were actually at that point in February, and that President Putin was very patient in trying to explain to the West why Russia is concerned about adversarial military forces being placed on the border. You know, we're at the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's what John F. Kennedy said about Soviet missiles in Cuba. And Putin's argument that you can't have this accepted by Russians for national security, you know, that's a valid argument, but it was rejected. And so there's going to have to be a change in thinking on the West. And I think what's going to start happening is the idea of spending billions of dollars to arm Ukrainians while people in the West don't have food, don't have heat. In the United States, the families of American servicemen and women are being told to go on food stamps because they're not getting enough money to cover for inflation to feed their children. And yet $60 billion is going to Zelensky and the Azov battalions to attack the Donbass. So I think the question is how clearly we can get a message that peace is the only way out, but peace is not a question of surrender. It's a question of mutual security. And President Putin has been clear that he's offering security guarantees to Ukraine as well as wanting them for Russia.
Mr. Schlanger, we have to leave it there, but I'm really grateful to you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and it was very good talking with you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.